Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, May 29, 2024, on 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. My co-host Ron Meniza is in the other room doing other stuff. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprouts. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live and Instagram Live episodes at Fran Storch ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on this show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. All right, so we're both hanging in there in terms of health and stuff. We're excited because it was Memorial Day weekend, and it's the unofficial start of summer, so that's pretty exciting. So anyway, here's more stuff about the Connecticut Naturopathic Physicians Conference. Very exciting. There was so much wonderful information. I just really wanted to share more of it with you. So here we go. Anyway, so last week I was talking about Patrick Fratelloni. Patrick Fratelloni is a functional medicine cardiologist, and he works with naturopathic physicians and other functional medicine people, and he studies herbs and natural medicine. So there was one piece that I forgot to talk about last week, which is this very interesting tidbit, which is people with Lyme disease, some patients get pacemakers because they have arrhythmias, especially bundle branch blocks. Bundle branch blocks are often caused by Lyme disease. And so they'll wind up being diagnosed with bundle branch blocks, not realizing they actually have Lyme disease. And they get pacemakers put in. And then when they figure out they have Lyme disease, they get treated for Lyme disease. However they get treated, antibiotics, herbals, whatever. They get rid of the Lyme disease. And sometimes they find they can have their pacemaker removed. So if you're diagnosed with an arrhythmia, it might be worth checking to see if you have Lyme disease. Definitely if you have a bundle branch block. In my experience, what I'm seeing around here is most people who get diagnosed with an arrhythmia have atrial fibrillation. I think it's probably worth getting checked to see if you have tick-borne illness, even if you have any arrhythmia at all, especially if you live in a place where tick-borne illness is endemic, which we do here in Connecticut and here in New England in general. And so that's a very interesting piece. Get checked out and then get treated for Lyme disease and see if your arrhythmia gets better. All right. So the next thing we talked about, I didn't want to go too into it because this is not something everybody's going to do or has access to, but you might want to consider it. And that is Lindsay Wells, naturopathic physician. She treats a lot of people with PANS and PANDAS. That's pediatric autoimmune neuropsychiatric syndrome. And PANDAS is pediatric autoimmune neuropsychiatric system, and then the DA, and I can't remember what the DA stands for. Anyway, she treats a lot of that, and one of the things she treats with is helminths. Helminths are a type of probiotic that instead of being a bacteria, a virus, or a fungus, it's a worm. Yes, it is. A helminth is a worm, and it's a specific species. It's Hymenolopsis diminuta cysticeroides. They only live in your digestive system, and they are a probiotic worm. Go figure. Okay. And what they do is they enhance TH2, which is something that calms your immune system. If you have an overactive TH1 cytokine response, the helminths can cause you to make more TH2. And so it'll calm your cytokine. So you have less inflammation going on in your body. So helminths will skew the cytokines. It will favor interleukin-4 over interleukin-17 and interferon gamma and have more conspicuous interleukin-10 and TGF-beta. So anyway, it reorganizes the immune system to a less inflammatory state. And yes, they're worms. How interesting is that? And if you think that's gross, just realize that there are places in the world where worms are endemic. People live with them. People have parasites on board, especially in Africa and other tropical places, places where worms are more likely to grow. And they live in your body and they're a commensal. They are only a problem if they overgrow. And in some cases, they can be probiotic. And in this case, this species, Hymenolepis species of worm is a probiotic, and it enhances the activity of the immune system, brings it into a less inflammatory state. Interesting, huh? All right, now I'm going to move on to, I was very pleased and happy to hear this talk, and this talk was by my friend, Lori Lee Schoenbeck, who, it was very exciting to listen to her because I was in naturopathic college with her my entire 4 years. And I don't know if it might have been the first time I was actually listening to a talk at a conference with someone who was actually my friend when I was in school. And I was with her the entire time. She started naturopathic college in 1990 and she went through in 5 years. She stayed a little extra, which is probably smart. And she graduated in 95. And I started in 91 and graduated in 95. So she graduated with my class. I have a picture of my graduating class on my wall in my office, which if you come to see me, you can look at the picture. She's in the picture. It's very exciting. So it was so great to listen to her. And she has done such wonderful things for the state of Vermont. She was one of the people who were instrumental in getting the Vermont law passed so that they could be primary care physicians and they could have prescriptive authority and just getting their licensure passed. I'll tell you a synopsis of what she talked about. And it's basically a history of naturopathic medicine, which I think bears repeating now and again. So it's our legacy and our history and very nice. So 6,000 years ago, the Ayurveda came into practice. And Ayurveda is a word that means the science of life in Sanskrit. And Ayurveda is still popular in India. And Ayurveda is used as a natural therapy all over the world now. I mean, you can go to Ayurvedic practitioners in the United States and use Ayurvedic principles in the United States. When you are consuming turmeric and coconut oil and other Ayurveda amla and triphala, those are all Ayurvedic herbs. And we use them in our practice now. I take curcumin, I take amla. I have taken triphala in the past. And I've taken moringa. All of these are Ayurvedic herbs. So Ayurvedic is the science of diet and lifestyle, and there's an herbal medicine, detoxification, physical medicine, massage with water and oil. And so an Ayurvedic massage will include you rubbing yourself with sesame oil every day, and spiritual practice and prana. Prana is your life force. It's basically the Ayurvedic cohort of chi. They are similar. They have parallel evolution. And it's prana in Ayurvedic medicine, and it's chi in Chinese medicine. And if you study yoga, at some point you'll be doing pranayama. Pranayama is a breath practice, and it's a practice of breathing. You access prana by doing breath work. You can alter prana and move prana in a more healthful way by following Ayurvedic principles. So that's what it's about. Then there was Chinese medicine. Chinese medicine is thousands of years old as well. And in Chinese medicine, you use herbs, you use acupuncture. There is also massage, and there's cupping and moxa. Cupping, if you don't know what cupping is where you have these, generally, they don't have to be glass, but they often are glass. They can be glass or ceramic, and they're placed on acupuncture, points along the meridians on your body, and they are cups, so you screw them tight so that they adhere to the body by vacuum suction, and then they move chi, and that's what they do, And because they affect blood flow, you wind up getting bruises around the cups. So if you ever watch a basketball game, you might see some of the basketball players have these big round bruises on their bodies. It's not because somebody hurt them. It's because somebody was using cupping as a therapeutic modality. And, you can tell your friends if they got cupping done, they're going to have these marks on their body. And so it's just another way of accessing the meridians and helping the meridians to flow properly. Then there's moxa. Moxa is a preparation that's meant to be burning. You take mugwort, which is Artemisia vulgaris, and you put it into a form that it's easy to burn, and you put the moxa either on an acupuncture needle or directly on the skin, and you burn it. And it adds heat to the meridian. And so that's something that's used in Chinese medicine. And then there's hydrotherapy. So hydrotherapy, Laura Lee talked a lot about hydrotherapy and how it was a very useful and easy therapy to use because it's the use of water for healing. It's great. It's easy, it's cheap, it's accessible. Anybody can do hydrotherapy. So she mentioned that somebody calls you over the weekend and you can't get to them and you can't get a supplement to them and they can't go anywhere. You can instruct them to do a hydrotherapy and the hydrotherapy can be just what they need. Hydrotherapy examples of hydrotherapy would be when we were in school, we did constitutional hydrotherapies. We would put sine wave on, if the person was lying on their back, the sine wave would be over their sacrum, and on their front, it would be over their solar plexus. And we would then, they would be lying on a blanket, and we would put a sheet over that, and then we'd get a hot towel and put it across their chest for 5 minutes, and then we take that off and put drenched in cold water, wrung out in cold water on their chest, and they would lie there wrapped up in blankets for 10 minutes, and then we flip them over and start over, hot towel for 5 minutes, cold towel for 10 minutes. And that's a constitutional hydrotherapy, and it's very powerful, and it can help to alter the immune system. You can do it at home by getting yourself nice and warm. You get yourself nice and warm in the shower. You don't even have to use a towel. And then you get a large towel that you can wrap completely around your entire torso from neck to pubis. And you wring it out in cold water. You wrap it around yourself. Wrap yourself around in a sheet. And then wrap yourself up in preferably a wool blanket or an otherwise very warm blanket. And you lie there for 20 minutes. And that's your home constitutional hydrotherapy that you can do to yourself. There's the wet sock treatment where you warm your feet up and you make sure your feet are nice and warm. Then you put thin cotton socks wrung out in cold water on your feet and you put warm wool socks over top of that. You go to sleep that way to draw congestion downward from your head. There's other hydrotherapies, the hot fomentation, and hot fomentations are great if you already have a fever or if you have chest congestion or congestion of any kind, or if you have pain, if you have back pain or other kinds of pain, you can do a hot fomentation, and that's where you, the person is, their feet are in a hot foot bath or on a heating pad, their back is on a heating pad, and their head has cold water, a cold washcloth on it. And then you take a hot towel, they're lying on a wool blanket with a sheet over it, hot towel to the chest, wrap them up for 3 minutes, do it again for 3 minutes, and then you take it off and you do a cold mitten friction to the chest. You repeat that, you repeat it a third time, but after the third time you just take everything off and then you do a cold mitten friction to their whole body. It's a very wonderful, effective treatment. I used to do it a lot more. It's not practical for me to do it now in my practice, but I do sometimes instruct people to do hydrotherapies at home. One of the easiest hydrotherapies to do is steam inhalations. That's where you take water and you put it on the stove and you boil it. Mind you, never put your face over an actively boiling pot. So you never put your face over the pot until you've turned the heat off and the heat is no longer going. So you can just and then you take a towel and you put it over your head and you breathe the steam in. Even better if you put essential oils or herbs into the water. And you can put in lavender or rosemary or thyme or tea tree or eucalyptus or any combination and breathe that in, and it'll help open up your sinus passages and help with infection. So hydrotherapy is great. And she talked about Priestnitz and Father Kneipp. And they were in Germany, and they made hydrotherapy very popular. In the 1700s, they were also in favor of nature cure, which was natural living, vegetarian diet, sunshine and fresh air. And Lindlar was one of our fathers, too. Then in 1830, the hygienic movement came to be. So Graham, who was from Suffield, Connecticut. Who knew? The guy who invented the graham cracker was from Suffield, Connecticut, where we are. And he wanted people to eat whole grains, and he said that eating a lot of sugar and too much meat wasn't good for you. So he got attacked by a mob of butchers and bakers. And then there was a guy from Trull, named Trull, who was a student of Graham, and he was from, guess what, Vernon. Really, I mean, not that far from here, right? A couple towns away. And he studied with Graham and also believed in sunshine, fresh air, moderation, and avoidance of alcohol, hydrotherapy, vegetarian diet, whole grains and bran instead of white flour, and countering germ theory with attention to the vis being the vis medicatrix naturae, which is the healing power of nature, which is the central tenet of naturopathic medicine. All right. So in the late 1800s, early 1900s, they were using a lot of heavy metals. So they were using things like arsenic and lead and cadmium in medicine. And those are toxic heavy metals, especially arsenic. And Thompson was a doctor that denounced this. And he talked about the use of plant medicine and personal responsibility, taking care of your own health, increasing your vital force, and treating with steam. He was a big believer in cayenne pepper for various uses. And cayenne pepper is very useful. And I think there are preparations that you put in your eyes, which I wouldn't necessarily recommend. But when you eat cayenne pepper, it's a nitric oxide enhancer, and it is antimicrobial. So it's helpful for a number of things. It's helpful for cardiovascular disease, and it's helpful for coughs. And it's helpful if you tend to be cold, you'll get more circulation if you use cayenne pepper. So he was a big fan of that. He really thought there should be no medical school and we should all be our own physicians. He didn't believe in their having doctors. He also was interested in Native American herbalism. Then there was the science of homeopathy, which was very popular in the 1800s. Homeopathy is the use of like cures like, where you're using very tiny amounts of medicine to tune into a frequency of healing in your body. And so homeopathic medicine was very popular, and they controlled hospitals, dispensaries, asylums for orphans, retirement homes and nursing homes, and even this is a terrible term, insane asylums. We don't say that anymore. We have psychiatric hospitals and just hospitals now, and insane is not a medical term anymore. I think it might be a legal term that you can be pronounced criminally insane, but you would not be, there's no diagnosis code for insanity. There's diagnosis codes for psychosis and brief psychosis and schizophrenia and major depressive disorder and things like that. But no, the insane is not a diagnosis. Okay, then there's the eclectic physicians, and the eclectic physicians were the most like us naturopathic physicians. Eclectic means that you do a lot of things and you use a lot of things and you like a lot of things. So an eclectic physician is going to use a lot of modalities, and that's what naturopathic physicians do. So the eclectic physicians were based in New England, and they used herbal medicine, nutrition, nature cure, which is fresh air and sunshine and water and stuff like that, and some conventional medicine as well. In 1880, there were 76 regular medical schools in the U.S., 14 homeopathic medical schools, and 8 eclectic medical schools. In the 1890s, osteopathy came to be. And so if you have a doctor who has D-O after the name, their name, they're a doctor of osteopathy. Osteopathic medicine was based on the idea that you can engage healing through manipulation of the spine. And osteopathic physicians do get training in osteopathic manipulation, similar to what chiropractors get. And a lot of osteopathic physicians don't necessarily practice now, because doctors of osteopathy have gotten it so that they can practice just like how MDs practice. And so a lot of them don't do osteopathic manipulation, but some of them do. And when you find someone who does osteopathic manipulation, it can be very effective. And so in osteopathic medical school, they get trained to do osteopathic manipulation, and they get extra training in nutrition. But like I said, because they can practice exactly as MDs in the entire United States, they often don't. So you can get somebody who's an osteopathic physician who's an orthopedist. The ones in stores are Corey Edgar and Matthew Hall. They're osteopaths. And you could be anything. I think Martin Hoffman, who's a gastroenterologist in Manchester or Hartford or something. Anyway, I think he's an osteopath as well. So you can be any specialty and be an osteopathic physician. Just how it is. Not so with naturopathic medicine. Christian Science was popular. And so you know what Christian Science is. Christian Science believes in the use of prayer to help with healing, and they don't use they don't use modern medicine. And then of course chiropractic came to being as well. And chiropractic, of course, is very, very helpful. I'm going to the chiropractor today, in fact. And chiropractic medicine believes in the spine as being the center of where illness lies. And when you adjust the spine, then you open up the neural pathways so that they can go to the organs and do what they're supposed to do. It's not just about fixing pain, but the focus tends to be on that. And generally, in various states, chiropractors can only fix the spine and only treat pain. And even though they are complete holistic practitioners, and there are chiropractors who also prescribe supplements, and there are states where they have a lot of rights, they can even order labs. And Connecticut has a rather limited scope of practice, but in Connecticut, I've seen chiropractors do various kinds of manipulation, some kinds of electrotherapy, and some of them do sell supplements as well and prescribe supplements. Chiropractic, I believe, is an invaluable profession. I don't know where I'd be without my chiropractor. I love my chiropractors. I think they're very useful. And what's nice about it is you go to an appointment, it's not super long, they do an adjustment and you feel better afterwards. It's great. Then don't forget the Lusts, Benedict and Louisa Lust. They're the ones who invented naturopathy. And Lindlar, Lustin Lindlar. We learned a lot about Lustin Lindlar. Boy, was that alliterative. Lustin Lindlar were our papa or mama. And Lindlar codified the philosophy and practice of naturopathic medicine. And then Spittler wrote the book Basic Naturopathy. In 1940, believe it or not, there were 13 naturopathy colleges, 13 licensed states, and 40,000 practitioners. I'm not sure how many practitioners there are in the United States. I looked around the room on Saturday, and I'm sad to say that there were a lot of empty seats, that there were 45 people attending the session. So I didn't count on Friday, but I don't know if some people came on Friday and didn't come on Saturday and vice versa. But there are only 45 people. I mean, and so Connecticut seems to maintain around 200 naturopathic physicians at any one time. I mean, we are a state of only 3.5 million people, but that doesn't seem to be a lot of practitioners. And one of the problems we have is that we can't prescribe. We don't have prescriptive authority. And there are other states that have licensure not far from here, like Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine, where they can prescribe. And I'm not sure where Massachusetts is at in terms of Massachusetts and Rhode Island are in the process of getting their licenses codified in their scopes of practice. I don't know if they're working on getting prescriptive authority. All right. And so there was a divide between Carroll and Lust. Lust was more natural medicine oriented, and Carroll was more about siding with the MDs. Vaccines became popular in the 1800s and the early 1900s. Anesthesia came about in the 1800s. Antibiotics came about in the 1900s. So we've only had antibiotics for about 100 years. Isn't that interesting? A little over 100 years. The American Medical Association was founded in 1901, and then the Flexner Report came out in 1910. And the Flexner Report basically dissed natural medicine. It said that natural medicine wasn't real medicine, and that there's a lot of problems with it. In the 1960s, there was only one naturopathic college and only 200 naturopathic physicians practicing in North America. And then in 1975, there had been no new licensed states in 20 years, and there were only 6 licensed states. And in Washington state, they made a law that said that naturopathic physicians couldn't diagnose or treat illness. In 1973, Joe Pizzorno, who's one of our fathers, he founded NCNM, the National College of Naturopathic Medicine. Teachers would come to teach at the naturopathic colleges for no charge, just to keep the profession going. And now there's a World Naturopathic Federation. In Europe, practitioners are naturopaths. They are not doctors. They're a separate profession from physicians. And in some countries, naturopaths are technicians. All naturopaths are united by the six basic principles. Let's see if I can rattle them off. Vits Medicatrix Naturae, which is the healing power of nature. First, do no harm, primum non nocere. Tali causam, look for the cause. Treat the whole person, tali totem. Provenzare, which is prevention. And, there's one more. There's one more that I'm not thinking of. I think of it, I will let you know. And so we're all united by those six basic principles. By 2024, now there are four-year accredited programs. You have to take board exams. There's state licensing and regulation. There's growing insurance recognition, which we do have in the state of Connecticut. There's national advocacy and world representation. We do have a danger of being co-opted by integrative medicine MDs. We are working on being added to the Social Securities Act so that we can see Medicare patients, because Medicare doesn't cover us right now at all, which is terrible because there is a primary care shortage. So many of my patients can't get into primary care physicians. Also, they call me their PCP. And I just want to be clear that in the state of Connecticut, naturopathic physicians aren't primary care physicians. We are specialists. Your insurance considers us to be a specialist, and the Act considers us to be a specialist. We are not primary care physicians. People name me as their primary care anyway, and they insist that I'm their PCP, and I tell them, no, I'm not. And then they have to go to the hospital, they go to the ER, they go to the urgent care, and I get the chart notes, and the PCP is listed as me. And that's really not supposed to happen. So just putting that out there. And I do tell my patients it's a good idea for them to have a primary care physician who is not me in case they need a prescription at some point, because sometimes you do. And then what people tend to do is they'll have me primarily, they'll come to me first, and I can be their first stop. And then if I think they need to go see an MD, I'll tell them. And, you know, if they have something acute, they can go to the urgent care. And what I don't like is that people will sometimes overuse the ER, which is a very expensive way to go. One of the things that's happening in our state is that there are patients who don't want to vaccinate their kids. And there are a lot of doctors who won't see unvaccinated children. A lot of pediatricians, they won't see unvaccinated children, either because they don't believe in it or because a lot of practices are being are either subsumed or choosing to go with these companies, either Hartford Healthcare or Yale New Haven or Trinity or smaller companies that basically oversee clinics like Starling and ProHealth, and they have rules that if a child's going to be in the pediatric practice, they have to be vaccinated. So the practices once they make that rule, if a child is in that practice, they'll let them go. They'll kick them out of the practice. So they come to see me because I don't have that rule. And I explain to them, I'm not your primary care. And what they wind up doing is coming to me for as much as they can. And then if they need acute care, they go to they access the ER or urgent care, which is a very expensive way to go. So really what they should do, in my opinion, is they should make us primary care physicians and give us prescriptive authority. And that's the other thing that's happening. I have so many patients who can't find a primary care physician because there's a shortage of primary care physicians. So they're using me as their primary care, which they really shouldn't be doing. It would be better if I was, in fact, a primary care physician, and then they could consider me that way. And if I had prescriptive authority, I could manage their pharmaceuticals. I could prescribe when needed, which I would like to be able to do. There are certain things I would like to be able to prescribe. It's more of a liability when you prescribe. I think our malpractice would go up, but I would like to be able to oversee and use pharmaceuticals in a more holistic, creative way, believe it or not. So, for example, we're going to talk about natural hormone replacement therapy. I would like to be able to prescribe that because a lot of gynecological practices won't prescribe it. They don't believe in natural hormone therapy. And I believe that if you're going to do hormone replacement therapy, it is the way to go. I would never give conjugated horse estrogens or progestins to somebody. I would consider giving oral contraceptives if I had to. I'm not crazy about oral contraceptives, but, you know, it's the main thing that people like to use. The chemical contraception is the main form of contraception that women like to use. And it annoys me that they're all of their options are not explained. And I am not allowed to prescribe, for example, a diaphragm or a cervical cap. So what I wind up doing is suggesting to people, if I think they shouldn't be on chemical contraception, that they go someplace like Planned Parenthood, which is very sex positive and tells you about all of the options for contraceptive care. All right. So let me see. So Association of Naturopathic Doctors is 20 years older than the AANP, the American Association of Naturopathic Physicians. So there are health effects of climate change, of course, heat-related illness and death, weather, pollution, vector ecology, allergies and asthma, water quality, water and food supply impacts, forced migration and civil conflict, and mental health. One of the things I was very excited about is Lori Lee specifically suggested that as a way to improve your health, that you should bike to work. And I cheered, and she saw me cheering and liked that. So that was fun. And she said she thought I was just cheering for exercise, but I was cheering specifically because she suggested riding your bike to work. And anything to do with a bicycle is going to get a cheer from me, of course. So naturopathic solutions, there are diets for healthy people and planet, sustainable low-cost treatments. There's decreased need for pharmaceuticals, decreased need for heavy footprint medical procedures like, you know, cardiovascular disease procedures like, coronary artery bypass grafts and you know, intense surgeries and things like that. People get more exercise and consume less and get patients in touch with nature. Then there's the concept of the wounded healer, the idea that if you have an illness, or if you have something wrong with you of any kind, when you go through healing that illness, you are then going to be able to learn how to help other people to heal, which is certainly true of me. If I get anything, that's why you hear me talking about what's going on with me and how I'm treating it, not because I want you to know about me in particular, but that I'm going through an experience of something I need to heal from, and here's what I'm doing for it, and maybe you would like to consider that as well. That's all. So when a naturopathic physician has an experience from inside of an illness, it's not any fun, but it does make it so that you can learn about the illness and you can speak to it from a place of experience, especially true for me with menopause, you know, that because I'm a postmenopausal person. Maybe I'm still, according to this talk by Robin Kutka, I may still be perimenopausal because I'm not 10 years out from my menopause. I will be next year. But I am not, well, actually, it'll be in October of 26 will be, because I was 51 when I stopped my period, but it was in October of 15. So I had not turned 52 yet. I was just about turned 52. So 10 years will be October of 25, I guess, because, well, my last menses was, now the world knows, my last menses was in October of 15. And so how old was I in October? Yeah, I was 51. I hadn't turned 52 yet. Right. Yeah. So in October of 25, that will be 10 years. And I'll be 61 and I will be, because this year I'm going to turn 61. Oh boy. Can't even believe it. Okay. So here's some profound things to remember. One is the crack in the wall that lets in light and water, and also the crack in the wall, water drips out. And when water drips out, it feeds the plants, and then a lot of healing happens from that. All right, so that was Lori Lee. It was a very inspirational talk. It was very inspirational to hear her speak. My dear friend from Naturopathic College, I hope I get to talk to her, see her again. Lori Lee was special because she had spent time at Kripalu becoming a yoga instructor. And while we were in school, at times she would teach yoga classes to us, and that was lovely. She was a lovely person. She still is. And she's a big deal in Vermont. So if you ever go to Montpelier, And she did mention, I believe her practice is in Montpelier, and Montpelier had a horrible flood. And she showed us photos of the horrible flood, and they had to help people who were victims of the flood, and they had all kinds of issues that they lost their homes and their businesses, and of course had a lot of psychosocial stress, and it was just an incredible, incredible time. All right, so now let's talk about Robin Kudka. Robin Kudka, so one of the things that we were supposed to do is there were four talks available virtually, and we had to do at least two of them to get all of our CEUs, our continuing education units. And she was one of them. So she gave a virtual talk that we were supposed to look at and then take the quiz to prove that we had done it. And then one of the talks was going to be about, bloodless surgery. And the person that was supposed to give the talk had an emergency, wasn't able to come. Robin happened to be at the conference, schlepped to us from Oregon or Washington, I can't remember now. And she was able to give her talk. She was flexible and she gave her talk impromptu, even though she'd already done the video. So I can rewatch her talk on video, and I have the slides, and I got to hear her in person. So she talked about the ethics of hormone therapy use in peri and postmenopause, which was very eye-opening for me, to say the least. All right, so here's some stuff about if you're interested in using hormone replacement therapy, this is an interesting talk to listen to. So menopause is considered to be when you are 12 months without having a cycle. The average age in the United States for stopping your period is 51. And I'm an unusual person in some ways. You might see that about me. I'm odd in some ways. I have quirks and I have things I like to do that are weird. There is a certain way that I am average, and that is I stop my period at 51, right at the age that that's the median age for women to stop their periods in the United States. Now, normal onset of perimenopause can be at 40. Now, when I lived in Newfoundland, most of my women patients were done with their menses by age 40, which means you can start perimenopause in your 30s. And so you want to consider if a woman is having certain symptoms in their 30s, it could be perimenopause. I have women coming to me all the time, please check my hormones. And you can help to treat them, however, for hormonal imbalances as early as their 30s, if you need to. And you have to consider that some women are perimenopausal in their 30s. If they're going to stop their period at 40, 41, 42, they're going to be perimenopausal in their late 30s. I started to be symptomatic in my mid-40s and then stopped my period in 51. So I had a few years where I was definitely perimenopausal and then stopped my periods at 51. My sister had a baby at 46. Yay, Marley. And so she stopped her period 2 years later than me at age 53. I mean, it was still after me because she's younger than me, but she's 53. And my mother stopped at 55. So I probably stopped at 51 because of a combination of stress and athleticism. When you're an athlete, you tend to stop your period sooner. And women have on the average, normal onset of menopause is 40 years. 6,000 women in the United States reach menopause per day. And by 2025, there will be 1.1 billion postmenopausal women in the world by 2025. And women have an average of 7 menopausal symptoms, 42% less than expected. 20% are 42% have less than they expect. 20% have uncommon. 20% think that they're not certain how the symptoms are going to last. They have negative effects on their work and relationships. There's a reluctance to talk about symptoms openly or consult a professional. People feel isolated and that information is insufficient. The symptoms you can have cardiovascular disease. You can have hip fractures or fractures of other parts of your body, other bones. You can have urinary symptoms, increased urinary tract infections. You can have urinary incontinence, stress incontinence. You have painful intercourse, painful sex of any kind. You can have vaginal dryness. You have an increased risk of diabetes. You have diabetes mellitus specifically. You can have sleep disruption. You can have concentration issues. Your short-term memory can go off. You can have mood swings, depression, anxiety, and fatigue. You can have headaches, palpitations. And your symptoms can take 8 to 10 years to settle out. Yay. And it's, like I told you, it's often overlooked in younger women. Menopause is a natural part of life, but Robin's contention was that you don't have to suffer, that if you are suffering, it's okay to do hormones. Because menopause causes $1.8 billion in lost working time a year. A third of working postmenopausal women have reduced job performance. 83% of respondents in a survey said it negatively affects their work. Partners don't know how to support them. 68% of divorces in menopause are initiated by wives. 65% of perimenopause affects their relationship. 73% of women blamed menopause for a breakdown in marriage, loss of intimacy. They find that they argue more and they have decreased communication, and employers don't support them in perimenopause. There was that Women's Health Initiative study that happened in the 70s or 80s. I remember when it came out. That reported that with that what they were looking at was Prempro. They were looking at a combination of Premarin, which is conjugated horse estrogens, and medroxyprogesterone, which is Provera, and it's not natural progesterone. And that was what they were looking at. And when women took those drugs, they had a 41% higher stroke risk, double the rate of blood clots, 26% of an increase in breast cancer risk. And so that made it so that doctors were a lot less likely to prescribe hormone replacement therapy because of that study, but they weren't thinking about bioidentical hormones. So the thing is, it depends on how you administer estrogens and how and what form it's in. And so you probably shouldn't give Premarin, you shouldn't give horse estrogens, because what I learned was that horse estrogens, that Equilin and Equinolin, are horse estrogens, and our bodies don't know how to break them down, so they accumulate in the body and they cause unwanted proliferation. So that's why you should give bioidentical hormones. So oral estrogen was found when women took oral estrogen of any kind, it's found to increase cardiac or C-reactive protein, which is an inflammatory marker, triglycerides, metalloproteinase 9, which is an inflammatory marker, negatively affects several clotting factors, antithrombin 3, factor 8, factor 7, also TNF, tumor necrosis factor alpha, which is an inflammatory compound, and IGF-1, which is also related to inflammation. Transdermal estrogen does negatively affect antithrombin 3, but doesn't increase thrombotic potential. So when you stop doing oral estrogen, all these side effects go away, right? So you do transdermal, you're going to, so basically a good idea, in my estimation, is going to be to use a patch. Because a patch, you're going to have a very regular, if you use a cream and you rub it on yourself, you're not going to get, you don't know exactly how much is getting on you. If you use a patch, it's pre-measured, it's you can get it by prescription, you can get bioidentical estradiol and slap it on, you change it twice a week and off you go. You have the slight risk in antithrombin 3, but all these side effects, you don't have them. Progestins do have negative side effects. So the only progesterone, in my estimation, that it's a good idea to take is natural progesterone. It should be natural progesterone. You can take oral micronized progesterone, or you can do sublingual oil, or you can do it topically. I think she was in favor of doing it topically. I'm not as excited about taking pills because I think you have to take a higher dose when you take the pill. My preference is sublingual oil, and you can get that from a compounding pharmacy. And if I were to take, I did take sublingual progesterone. And after listening to this talk, I'm considering, do I want to do natural hormone replacement therapy? So Robin believes there was an overreaction by the media to the Women's Health Initiative study, and that younger women can benefit from hormone replacement therapy. It's beneficial to the cardiovascular system, decrease in all-cause mortality, low breast cancer rates, and decreased risk. Natural progesterone decreases your breast cancer risk. Since the Women's Health Initiative study, there has been an increase in osteoporotic fractures. So that's interesting. So that hormone replacement therapy helps to prevent bone density issues. Women are not always supported by their practitioners. I know there are area gynecological practices that won't prescribe. They will prescribe pharmaceutical-based they will prescribe pharmaceutical-based hormone replacement, but they won't prescribe natural hormone replacement therapy. But a lot of practitioners won't prescribe at all. They're afraid of that increase in breast cancer risk, but the risk is very low, and it's less than or equal to modifiable risk factors such as alcohol intake and sedentary lifestyle. So if you can take hormone replacement therapy, do all the other things. Eat good, eat your fruits and vegetables, eat your clean protein, eat your nuts and seeds, eat your fiber, get your exercise, get your rest, and you do all those things. And you're probably not gonna get breast cancer. There is no added effect of breast cancer with breast cancer family history. 2023 meta-analysis showed that estrogen therapy decreases breast cancer incidence and mortality. There were 10,700 women with estrogen alone or placebo. Estrogen lowered breast cancer risk, incidence, and deaths. Estrogen plus progestin, not progesterone, progestin, which is synthetic progesterone, increases risk. There is a reduced breast cancer risk with estrogen using conjugated estrogens, E1 and E2. There's a reduced breast cancer risk with estrogen plus oral micronized progesterone. So you can do the OMP. Progesterone lowers your breast cancer risk. Estrogen plus progestin, fake progesterone, increases your risk. Estrogen alone, there is no increased risk. So if for some reason you're taking estrogen alone, like your doc says, you don't need progesterone because you don't have a uterus, your risk is still decreased. I wouldn't do that. I would prefer, I think it's a good idea to take estrogen plus progesterone because that's what your body's supposed to have both. And estrogen plus progesterone doesn't increase and may lower risk of breast cancer. So if someone is at risk of cardiovascular disease directly or with diabetes mellitus, you can still do hormone replacement therapy. You just do transdermal. So that was very interesting, and it made me think about all these people who I'm discouraging from doing hormone replacement therapy. And somebody asked her, isn't menopause a natural part of life? And when we add hormones back, aren't we subverting nature? And Robin's attitude was, well, we sort of are, but we're living longer than we ever have before, and we're living longer. So you get your menopause at 51, and then you're going to live to 90. So you're spending 40 years on the planet without hormones, where people used to die either sooner than that or not long after that. And now we live much longer, and we're not only are we living longer, we're still busy. I mean, you're in your early 50s. You still have, if you're a middle class or lower class person, I mean, lower class, this sounds terrible. If you are a working person, you still have a good 15 years left of your work life, maybe more. So, and you're doing it without the benefit of the hormones, which make you feel good. And so it might be a good idea to take some hormones. And it really got me to thinking about this. So if I were going to recommend hormone replacement therapy, I would insist on bioidentical hormones. Robin said that E1, so there's three basic forms of estrogen. There's E1, E2, and E3. E3 is estriol, and estriol is at the highest concentration in our bodies, and it is the weakest because you don't want to overstimulate estrogen receptors. So you have more estriol in your body than estrone and estradiol, which are E1 and E2 respectively. E1 is no longer given. She explained why. I don't remember why anymore. But E2 is usually given by itself. And I think that's fine. If you give the right dose of E2 and then you supplement that with natural progesterone, a woman can feel very comfortable and you might get her, all the symptoms may go away. Better sleep, better thought process, more energy, able to build muscle better. There's all kinds of things that can improve. And so we shouldn't be so afraid. What I got from this is we shouldn't be so afraid of hormone replacement therapy. If you really don't want to take hormone replacement therapy, you do not have to. If you would prefer to, if you don't have enough symptoms to warrant it, that's perfectly fine. It is a choice. And if you're not taking them because you're afraid of the risks of cancer and stuff, and you're sort of on the fence, I'm telling you that you might not need to worry. As long as you do, I think it's a good idea to do bioidentical estrogen. So estradiol that you can get prescribed by your PCP is fine. And then make sure you're also getting bioidentical progesterone, whether oral micronized which is just a pill, or anything that says oral micronized progesterone is natural progesterone. Or you can go through a compounding pharmacy and get sublingual oil. And I like the sublingual oil because it's much easier to tweak the dose. And it's not the same as taking it orally, where you have the first liver pass. The first liver pass means you take a pill and it gets into your bloodstream. And then it goes through your liver and it makes metabolites. And when you put the sublingual oil in, it's being absorbed under your tongue. So you can do a lower dose. And because you're using an oil, that when you use the oil, the dropper that you're using is calibrated. So you can do micro adjustments of your dose. And I really love that. I think there's a lot of hormones, a lot of meds that should be administered that way. Thyroid is one of them. Anything that's a hormone, you should be able to tweak the dose. And in fact, a lot of things you should really be able to tweak the dose. That's why liquids and powders and oils are good things, because you can micro-tune the dose, and micro-tuning is a good thing, right, Kite? why I said that is because my friend Kite developed the Kite guitar, and it's all about micro-tuning of this guitar. Well, wouldn't you love to be able to micro-tune your medicine? I think that's a great thing to do. All right, so the take-home is maybe don't be so afraid of natural hormone replacement therapy, and talk to your doctor about it and see if they can provide it to you. You can get certain doses lower doses of estrogen and progesterone over the counter. You can get up to 40 milligram dosages of over the counter progesterone, and I forget what the dose is for estrogen, but you can get topical estrogen over the counter. It's just not going to be in the potency that if you were to get an estradiol patch. It won't be the same potency, but that's interesting. All right, so now let's see if we get through this. I only have a few minutes left. My colleague, Dr. Peter Buongiorno, love that name, Buongiorno, good morning, or good day, actually, in Italian. Anyway, Peter Buongiorno, he frequently speaks at conferences, so I've seen him a lot. This time he talked about sleep, GABA, and the microbiome. So sleep is super important. My friend Beth says anything can come from sleep. Better sleep can get you better practice at work. It can get you a healthier, you'll be stronger in your workouts. You'll just be happier and more rested. Helps your mood, helps your immune system, helps so many things. She's right about that. So he talked about sleep, the microbiome. I don't think we're going to get through very much of this, so I'm going to pick up on this next week. So anyway, GABA is gamma-aminobutyric acid. It is a calming neurotransmitter, and a lot of things that help you to sleep and help you with anxiety enhance the function of GABA in your body. When you don't have good GABA function, you're going to have more trouble sleeping. You're going to be more anxious, and you're just not going to be as happy. GABA gets to the brain by way of the vagus nerve, that all-important nerve that controls so much of your body, that wandering nerve that goes throughout your body. And the vagus nerve takes it into your brain directly through the blood-brain barrier. When you're in the alpha state of sleep, which is your first slow wave of sleep, GABA will regulate REM and non-REM sleep. REM is your rapid eye movement sleep that you really need to detox your brain. And non-REM sleep is the sleep you use to detox your body. So GABA receptors, there's A receptors that are ionotropic, which mean calcium flows in, and there's hyperpolarization. And then there's GABA receptors that are metabotrophic, and they're coupled with G protein, which allows potassium to flow out of neurons, and they do hyperpolarization. And then GABA GABA is ligand gated, where two GABAs bind and chloride flows in, it causes hyperpolarization. And then there's the benzodiazepine receptor at the junction of alpha and gamma. That's rho. GABA rho was the ligand gated. So the junction of alpha and gamma, barbiturates, alcohol, and propofol hit the benzodiazepine receptor, as do benzodiazepines, your alprazolam, anything, those LAMs, your diazepam, alprazolam, clonazepam, chlordiazepoxide, which is not a bazam, but it is a benzodiazepine, oxazepam, there's a ton of them. But people, my patients are on benzodiazepines, usually they come in on Ativan, which is lorazepam, or they come in on, the three they come in on are alprazolam, I think, is the most common, followed by somewhere between lorazepam and clonazepam. That's what they come in on. I think those guys are short-acting, and so docs like to prescribe short-acting ones, so there's less risk of dependence, and having said that, they still get dependent on them. And so glutamate, which this is very interesting, glutamate is an excitatory amino acid, and it is converted by glutamate decarboxylase to GABA. So you have an excitatory amino acid that gets converted to GABA. That's very interesting. Probiotics increase serotonin and tryptophan in mice. And so citalopram is a drug that also does that. And probiotics help that too. So there's some really basic things you can do to help yourself to sleep, to help with your mood. And that is to get good sleep, to get regular exercise, to drink plenty of water, and all of those things are going to help you with your sleep and your mood. And so the other thing to... so here's what... We know how Ron... We were talking to Ron, and he's always like, that's a big D-U-H. The gut microbiome changes rapidly with diet. So if you eat yucky food, you're not going to have a good microbiome. You're going to have poor gut bacteria. And if you eat good food, you're going to have a better microbiome. And that is where we are going to leave off this week. And I will finish talking about this next week. It's very interesting. And then we will go into cardiovascular health. But this is a very rich talk. It has a lot of interesting things to talk about. And then we'll talk more about cardiovascular health. So... That was nice. So I was very excited about the CNPA conference because I learned a lot. I was very inspired, and I hope that it makes it so that I change some things for the better and reflect upon myself and my practice and my life and help to incorporate some of the things that I was fed with, even if it's just reconnecting with all those great people that I connected with. I have a bunch of people I want to connect with since after the conference, including Rick Leva and Lori Lee and Gwen and Corrine. Those are the top four. And then there's more. There's probably more, but those are my top four. Anyway, you've been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, and Spotify. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live and Instagram Live episode at Fran Storch, ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org.